This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about energy insecurity, when households lose access to utility services like electricity, heating, and cooling, and how the issue has changed during the pandemic. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. We'd love to hear your voice in the conversation today. Call 866-476-3881. We just need your first name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation. 866-476-3881. Or use our new app, All In Vox Pop, to send us a high-quality audio message, and we'll try to get it in front of our guests. Our two guests are David Koniski, the principal investigator and professor at Indiana University O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs. David, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And I should say principal investigator in the study, which we'll be talking about. And, of course, Kerwin Olson is also with us, executive director of Citizens Action Coalition. Kerwin, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
So, David, what is energy insecurity, if we could sum it up?
Sure. Well, energy insecurity, broadly defined, simply is a situation where a household has difficulty meeting their energy needs, right? So this could be, you know, having difficulty paying for electricity bills or natural gas or other utilities. It could also broadly mean having challenges meeting transportation energy demands, right? So when people are faced with this situation, it has lots of sort of cascading effects in terms of their well-being. And, you know, it's just another form of material hardship that people often face.
I guess if we could look at a basic level, why is this such a problem across the country?
Yeah, you know, energy we sort of take for granted too often, right? But it's really a basic human need, right? Where we're thinking about, you know, keeping our homes cool during hot summer months, or keeping our homes warm during the winter, right? It's really an essential need. Refrigeration, lighting, all the kinds of things that we take for granted. Perhaps, you know, we only really remember how important these things are when we're without them, right? So when there's a power outage, for example, we are all inconvenienced by the loss of power. And when we're thinking about energy insecurity as more of a chronic condition, or something that is, you know, prevalent for particularly low-income households, you know, they may be faced with situations where they lose service for a week or 2 weeks or a month, right? And that is a real significant hardship that can affect their well-being as well as their health.
How long has this been a significant enough issue to talk about?
Well, I think it is a chronic problem in the sense that there are, you know, there's millions of households across the country that face energy insecurity all the time, right? There are particular, you know, months of the year where they are faced with the challenge of not being able to pay an energy bill. And this can result in receiving notices from their utility providers that they may lose service, right? In some cases, people, in fact, do lose access to these services. So in many respects, this is a very prevalent and ubiquitous problem, particularly among the lowest income households in the country. And what we're seeing now with the pandemic and with all of the economic disruption that has occurred, that it is being amplified, right? The problem's becoming exacerbated across the country.
Kerwin, what work does Citizens Action Coalition do regarding energy insecurity here in Indiana?
Citizens Action Coalition is very active at both the Indiana State House and working towards policies to protect consumers and make energy and other utility services more affordable. And we also do the bulk of our work before the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, intervening in cases filed by electric, gas, water, and sewer utilities, representing primarily residential consumers, with an eye towards protecting vulnerable populations and low-income populations, ensuring that we're doing all we can to make sure they have access to affordable essential human services.
And I'll kind of ask one of the questions I asked David, and I'll ask you through, I guess, the lens of the Citizens Action Coalition. One of the things I asked David was, how long has this been a problem? So I guess one thing I could ask you is, how long has Citizens Action Coalition been addressing this?
Well, we were founded back in 1974 during the energy crisis, when prices were high, supplies were low. And consumers really had little voice in the process related to the cost of energy. So it's been a problem for a very long time, exacerbated, most recently, we believe, by, income inequality issues and just a lack of sufficient income for people to meet basic needs. Also, we've seen, you know, trends in electricity prices, and most especially the price of water and wastewater services that is far out trending any increases in income, disability benefits, Social Security, and those type of things. So it's a lack of sufficient income to meet basic needs, but it's also a housing stock, you know, that low-income populations tend to live in, that are poorly insulated, older housing stock where energy costs are much higher, because the housing stock, to be quite frank, is not the same quality and is inefficient.
I will echo the water and sewer costs. It seems like my bill keeps going up in that regard. But as you've sort of pointed to some of the historical reasons for energy insecurity, I mean, I guess when we look at the timeline from 1974, the founding of the Citizens Action Coalition, to now, then being the low supply, high demand, and therefore high cost of energy, and now with the problems of economic inequality, what have been a lot of the reasons, or some of the reasons, throughout that 40-plus year timeline for energy insecurity? Have a lot of them looked the same?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've seen also a decrease in federal funding and support for our infrastructure needs across the country, you know, both with water and wastewater, but also with electricity and gas. We've seen, you know, high fluctuations in natural gas prices over the year. Matter of fact, in the mid-80s, under the Ronald Reagan administration, is when the low-income heating and assistance program was first created, which also included the weatherization assistance program to address the inefficient housing stock that low-income customers face. So I think it's been not only struggles with income sufficiency, but also a decrease in federal support to pay for some of these infrastructure needs. Now, ratepayers are becoming a substitute for taxpayers for many of these initiatives and these improvements.
So what specific changes are Citizens Action Coalition pushing for across the state?
Well, I think what we need to see is we have always been pushing for programs that make utility bills affordable on a monthly basis. We see you know, scores of rate cases filed at the commission every year with Nary and I, you know, pointed towards, can customers actually afford the rate increase that they're going to be saddled with? So we have been pushing for programs to provide, you know, affordable utility bills. Most of the funding that we have available to assist vulnerable populations with their utility bills are merely based on crisis needs and hardship funding, not looking towards affordability metrics and what should those bills be on a monthly basis to be affordable. Furthermore, one of the big components here, which is why we appreciate Professor Kaninsky's work so much, is just a lack of data. We have struggled for years to get utility companies to report very, very critical data, such as number of disconnects on a monthly basis, number of reconnects on a monthly basis, as well as arrearages that customers face on a monthly basis. And we need regular reporting of these payment problem indicators to sort of assess on an ongoing basis the state of home energy security. And up until this point, we've had a real difficulty in getting quantitative data reported to the commission related to the state of affairs of energy security in our state.
And I wanted to bring Professor Kaninsky back into this, but I want to follow up on that, Kerwin. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's been hard to get that data?
It's really puzzling to us. The utility companies work very aggressively at the State House to stop any efforts to get utility reporting requirements in place in statutes. Many states require the reporting of utility data. You know, we have a regulatory commission who is obligated to not only protect the financial health of the utility company, but also advocate on the behalf of the consumers. And we collect all kinds of data related to the financial health of a utility company, yet we don't bother to collect data related to customers. And so I think it's, you know, utilities not wanting legislators to see the payment difficulties that customers are currently experiencing. And we really don't understand that. We can't wrap our heads around why our elected officials and other policymakers don't have any interest in understanding the state of affairs of consumers and whether or not they can afford their bills. It's puzzling to us.
David Kaninsky, can you tell us more about this study, or the study, I guess, that you're leading? Why energy insecurity, would you say?
Yeah, well, in part, I'll just underscore what Kerwin just said, is we don't have a great understanding of, sort of in a quantitative sense, of the extent of this problem. We have some limited data from a periodic survey that is done by the federal government on energy insecurity. But as Kerwin noted, the ability to understand what's happening in terms of utility debt that customers might have or disconnections is just not readily available in most states from utilities, right? So we began the study in part to begin to answer some of our inquiries, some of our questions about the prevalence of energy insecurity. So what we've been doing over the course, we're going to do over the course of a year, and we're about midway through our project, is to, we've conducted a survey of low-income households, which we've defined as households at 200%, at or below 200% of the federal poverty line. And we're interviewing them four times over the course of the year to get a better understanding of the degree to which people are facing these energy insecurity challenges, and just as importantly, how they're coping with that challenge. So we did an initial wave of our survey back in May, which you recall was during a period of time when almost everybody was at home, right, because of the pandemic, and there was a tremendous amount of economic disruption in terms of unemployment and just sort of hardship coming from loss of income from that. And then we've gone back out and re-interviewed people in August, and we'll do so again over the course of the next 6 months or so. So what we're trying to do is trace this problem of energy insecurity over time to see how people are doing in face of all of these economic challenges because of the pandemic. The main motivation for the study is just to get a better understanding of who's affected by this problem, sort of the prevalence, but also which subgroups of the population is this more prominent in. And one of the key findings so far is that we see not only is this prevalent among all low-income households, but there are disparities. For example, Black households, Hispanic households are much more likely to not only have problems paying bills, but to receive threats of shutoff from the utilities. In addition, people with young children in their homes, households where someone relies on an electronic medical device are also more often in these situations. So part of our study is trying to understand who's being affected and how they're handling that situation.
And we will dig into more on the study when we come back. We're talking today about energy insecurity across the country and specifically in Indiana during the pandemic. We would love your input. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about energy insecurity across the country and Indiana during the pandemic. We would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. And there's a new way to send voice messages to All In. You can download our new app called All In Vox Pop and lets you send us voice messages without making a call. And they're much higher quality this way. We'll let you know what topics we're covering through the app. We can send you messages that way, and you can send questions or comments anytime with a tap on your phone. Just search in your phone's app store for All In Vox Pop. That's VOXPOP. And we are back with our two guests, David Kaniski, the principal investigator for the study that we're referring to today, a professor as well at Indiana University O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and Kerwin Olson, executive director of Citizens Action Coalition. Kerwin Olson, just before the break, we heard from David Kaniski that there are a number of racial disparities when we're talking about energy insecurity. In what ways is the Citizens Action Coalition addressing this? And how long, I guess, have we known about these?
Well, yeah, the professor's research is consistent with other research we've seen from National Consumer Law Center and NAACP, for example, that display Hispanic households, African-American households experience a much higher energy burden than do their white counterparts. We have raised these issues at the commission in rate case proceedings before the commission where we've had John Howitt, an expert at National Consumer Law Center, file his research and his information related to these data points that David mentioned. And we're trying to utilize that information to stimulate a dialogue before the commission related to these needs.
And I'm obviously energy insecurity is directly related to income insecurity and income disparities. And there are a number of those that are known along racial lines, unfortunately. But when if we were to look at white people, I guess, who are income insecure versus their level of energy insecurity, I mean, are there differences there between white people who have less money and then people of color who have less money with regard to income or with regard to energy insecurity?
Well, I think when you look at the data, what it has shown is that, you know, it's difficult to gather that type of data. We have to do our best using, you know, census block data, zip code plus four to try to narrow down on the demographics of those zip codes. But it does show that there's a higher number of minority populations with payment difficulties and struggles. But certainly there are low income Caucasian and white households too, who also suffer from payment problems. No question about it.
Well, I guess what I was trying to get at is whether or not we know if shutoffs happen more often for families of color versus white families. Do we have that information, or is that something that we have yet to look into?
Well, NAACP did a report, a Lights Out report, a year or two ago that showed, yes, disconnect numbers are certainly higher among Black and Latino populations than they are among white populations. And this is where collecting that data is critically important to understand not only the number of disconnects, but where are these disconnections occurring. So based on the NAACP report, yes, they have some data that they have presented, and we continue to work to try to acquire this data as well.
David Kaniski, in your research, you mentioned the CARES Act and stimulus checks. Can you explain what funding sources are available for people who are dealing with these issues? We've touched on a couple this hour already, but what else do you have?
Sure. I will address that question, but I thought it might be helpful just to reveal a little bit from our survey, which can answer that previous question that you're asking really
Please.
Directly. So you know, you sort of asked this question, is this you know, we of course know on average, you know, many Black households are also lower income households, right? So it's kind of hard to tease apart the independent effects or, you know, the sort of the causes of energy insecurity. But what we've learned through our survey research is that because we're only surveying low income households, right, and even then controlling for income differentials, we are seeing that not only are people of color more likely to have difficulty paying bills, but they're more likely to have their utility service lost through a disconnection, right? So at least through our survey research, we are seeing that there's something sort of unique or specific to households of color who are facing these situations. But as Kerwin said, we would really like to get more data from the utilities themselves so that we could actually sort of trace this in a much sort of more larger systematic way across the country.
And I guess before we get to the CARES Act question, I want to follow up on that. Have you had as much difficulty getting that data as they seem to have had there at Citizens Action Coalition?
No, yeah, Kerwin has it exactly right. These data are not readily available. It varies by state, it varies by utility, and there is no sort of central repository where we have great information on who is being disconnected, where they live, what are their characteristics. So it's quite challenging to get your sort of hands around this problem and in all of its dynamics. So, you know, I think it's really good and important that, you know, organizations like Kerwin's are working to try to put pressure on states to change the rules so that we have better reporting, more complete reporting. That go a long way towards us understanding the full extent of this problem.
Well, let's look at the CARES Act funding. As I understand from an abstract that I read on the study that you did, it seems a number of Black and brown households did not receive CARES Act stimulus checks the way so many of us did.
That's right. So, you know, the CARES Act was designed to provide different kinds of assistance. So there was assistance through direct cash payments that everybody was supposed to receive, at least below a certain income threshold. There was the enhanced unemployment benefits, insurance benefits. One of the things we've learned through our survey is that, you know, much smaller proportions of the population than you might think receive these checks. So in our data, and recall, these are low-income households across the country. We found that only about 38% of our respondents reported that they received their CARES check. And it was only 30% of African-American and Hispanic households. So we had this program designed to get money quickly into the hands of people who most need it so they could take care of their basic household needs. But our, you know, reporting, our survey suggests that the money was not received by these households.
Okay, so then I would imagine government assistance has been helpful to people who got it. But when I hear that, it doesn't sound like everyone did. So I guess, can we point to how helpful the assistance has been overall?
Well, I mean, we can certainly say from our analysis of our survey, for households that did receive this assistance, it made a difference, right? We see much lower rates of energy insecurity among those households. So I think as designed, the money was, you know, sort of targeted for those households. And for those that did have the good fortune of receiving it, it made a difference. And that's important, right? We need to figure out, especially if we're going to do a second round of a recovery program, how to make sure that everybody is able to benefit from this cash assistance program.
We're talking today about energy insecurity in Indiana and across the nation as well. And we do have a listener voicemail from someone in Evansville with a question about solar panels. Let's listen.
I understand that there's money available for HUD housing to install solar panels in HUD housing or on the roofs of HUD housing. And I think it could save poor people millions of dollars a year. And I was wondering what's being done about actually doing that in Indiana. Thank you.
Kerwin Olson, do we know anything about taking advantage of some of these programs to get solar panels up there to subsidize some of the energy usage in low-income areas?
Well, there's no question that there's definitely a focus on the power of solar energy, if you will, not only to reduce our emissions and mitigate the impacts of climate change, but also the direct benefit of reducing electricity costs to customers. So, yes, there's been a concerted effort nationwide and here in Indiana to find creative ways and also find out what available funding streams are out there to start deploying solar energy, especially for low-income populations and public housing projects that would stand to benefit not only reducing costs to the end user on their utility bills, but also when you talk about public housing, you're talking about taxpayers and saving taxpayers' revenue. So, yes, there is definitely a strong interest and focus on ways in which we can utilize solar energy for many, 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 many reasons, not the least of which is energy affordability.
But as I'm sure you're aware, and we're aware, too, because we did a whole show on solar energy in Indiana and a number of the efforts, I guess, perhaps not the least of which, the one that was mentioned by the caller, there is a big solar energy can be cost prohibitive at the outset. How much, when we're talking about low-income people, of course, when we're talking about low-income household, it's sort of federally subsidized and also subsidized by the state. So there's some money there, but how much of a challenge is it to implement something like that?
Well, the upfront costs are challenging, no question about it. But with the right rate-making mechanisms in place and with the right incentives in place, we can bring down that payback period, if you will, to the person or individual that makes that investment. Furthermore, with the weatherization assistance programs that provides funding to weatherize low-income homes and low-income housing facilities, they're beginning to explore ways in which to incorporate solar into the existing funding streams that we already have as a means of energy efficiency. So, yes, but it's also utility specific related to what sort of incentives and mechanisms are we providing customers. And I'm sure on your solar program, you probably discussed the end of retail net metering in Indiana, which is a recent development that's unfortunate. And so we're also working to try to continue net metering in our state to make sure that solar remains a financially attractive option for customers.
Are there forces against, when you brought up net metering, it's kind of fuzzy to point at who and why that came about. But obviously, there are forces against it. Are there forces against these other efforts of energy efficiency with regard to low income housing? And if so, are we even aware of where it's coming from?
I don't know that there are efforts against energy efficiency for low-income housing. We've all acknowledged that reducing the energy burden of low-income customers is a good thing, and we provide a fair amount of financial support to make that happen. It does become challenging because when you're talking about instituting energy efficiency measures or solar, we have to remember that we have 117 electric utilities in the state of Indiana, all with different sets of regulations and oversight, all with different tariffs and mechanisms. So it can be complicated. And that's why we need sort of statewide consistency and rules for customers when it comes to these incentives. There is some opposition to spending money on things like energy efficiency and solar from those who are opposed to government assistance programs, if you will. But generally speaking, most folks are supportive of efforts to increase efficiency investments in low-income housing.
We have a listener voicemail from Bobby who has a story about someone dealing with energy issues. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Bobby, and I'm calling you from Muncie. I've been trying to help someone who has her electricity turned off. She also has no gas because of a prior bill, so her whole house had been converted to all electric. And she told me that she had just talked to the electric company, and they told her she could have it turned on for $740. And I still have my $1,200 that the government gave me that I don't deserve. And I said, I'll do it for you. And I called up with my charge card and was going to charge $740 and get her electricity turned on. And it turned out that that was very, very naive. She wasn't just turned off. The electric company canceled her as a customer, which would mean she'd have to reapply and pay this exorbitant fee to reapply. It was almost $400, $395. And she would have to pay the entire back service, which was over $1,500. Added up, it was almost $2,000 that it would have cost to turn her electricity on. I can see no reason for this reapplication and to pay the fee over again for an existing customer. I know she doesn't pay her bills very well, but that was just totally, I feel, just totally wrong of the electric company to require someone to reapply. It just made no sense to me. But I do, from helping these people, I do realize their sense of time has so much to do with why they get themselves in trouble. And I know as far as time goes, I'm letting this run too long, so I'll go now. But thank you. Bye-bye.
Bobby, thank you for your story. We appreciate it. Kerwin Olson, how common are stories like the one Bobby shared about her neighbor?
Oh, they are all too common, very unfortunate and very heartbreaking and very disappointing, because what we're talking about here is utility service, electricity. We're talking about essential human services that are necessary for, Hoosiers to participate in society in a meaningful way. And, we have had attempts at the State House over the last 40 years to have bills introduced, capping the amount of deposits that utility companies can require folks to pay. Those efforts have fallen flat. These stories, we hear them all the time at field hearings, where there was an individual in Fort Wayne a year or two ago that testified. He has a senior citizen. He has a disabled wife, only got a 2% increase in his cost of living for his Social Security. And they've got to choose on a daily basis between paying utility bills and picking up prescriptions and putting food on the table. And so this is where we need legislators to step in and, at a minimum, at least put maximums on the amount that utility companies can charge for deposits? And can we at least exempt low-income and fixed-income households from the burden of having to pay deposits, pay late fees, pay these reconnect fees? All told, one utility, their low-income customers paid nearly $1 million in late fees over the course of 2 years. And so it seems to make sense to us from a public policy perspective that when we're talking about essential human services and vulnerable Hoosier populations, that we should limit, if not restrict, the ability of utility companies to make it even more difficult for folks to remain connected and live their lives in dignity. It's heartbreaking to hear stories like these.
So just a little over a minute left. David Kaniski, I want to bring you back in your research, of course, or through your research. I don't know, what more would you say the government could be doing to help families at risk of being disconnected?
Yeah, well, I think there are things we can do in the short term and then approaches we could take for the long term. In the short term, we need to better invest in the kinds of emergency relief programs that are out there but that are underfunded. For example, the federal government has a low-income home energy assistance program, which is intended to provide cash assistance to families when they're faced with a difficulty paying a bill. And unfortunately, that's an underfunded program. The dollars are always exhausted before all of those who are in need are able to access them. So finding ways to better invest in those kinds of programs would go a long way. But longer term, we need to figure out ways to do things like weatherization to improve the energy efficiency of people's homes, to give landlords incentives to improve energy efficiency of their apartments, and to generally, you know, make sure people have functioning heating and cooling systems, all these kinds of longer term goals, which would make our use of energy more efficient and would have the benefit of reducing people's bills.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with a leading researcher and advocate on issues around energy and security in Indiana and across the country. If you have questions or comments for our guest today, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or leave us a high-quality voice message with our new All In Vox Pop app. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on energy insecurity during the COVID-19 pandemic. As always, we welcome your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881, or download our new All In Vox Pop app to send us a high-quality audio message straight from your phone. And we'll kick off this segment with a question from Kevin on Facebook, who asks, is energy insecurity in Indiana another issue of profits over people, greed over helping people? Kevin also wonders if it's time to return to public-owned utilities or nonprofit utilities. Kerwin Olson, how often do you hear those kinds of questions?
Oh, we hear them all the time. I mean, we are talking about the majority of customers in the state of Indiana, at least on the electric and gas side of things, being served by investor-owned utilities, you know, with a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders. However, you know, we can address, you know, the utilities' need to deliver earnings and profits to their shareholders on Wall Street with putting in place some basic consumer protections at the State House. So it's not the utility companies necessarily that deserve our ire. It's those that oversee those utility companies and set the rules and policies and laws that govern utility operations in the state, most notably consumer protections. And that's why it's so hard to continue our work at the State House in trying to get legislators to enact, you know, rules and policies that protect consumers while at the same time, you know, keeping utility companies financially healthy. Nobody wants unhealthy financial utilities with bad credit ratings. That would lead to higher rates. But at the same time, just like my previous answer, we can put in place policies that at least protect consumers at a minimal level, consistent statewide, so the rules are the same for everyone.
What about Kevin's question about public-owned utilities, a return to public-owned utilities? Are there issues with that as well?
Oh, you know, that's an argument. At least, you know, we lost 100 years or so ago when, you know, the electricity markets first started in this country. The battle, if you will, between public and private power. You know, we created, you know, these natural monopolies. But, you know, utility investments, very, very high capital costs. And so, you know, some private, you know, market-based funding is needed to support those efforts and attract investment. You know, I think in an ideal world, we all would support the idea of nonprofit, publicly held power companies and water utility companies, et cetera. However, we also have to make sure that the lights come on when we turn on the light switch and water comes out of the faucet when we turn the knob. So I think in an ideal world, sure, public power sounds great, but it's a little more complicated than that because we like reliable service. And that takes a lot of investment. So some private investment, you know, can be required.
David Kaniski, we talked earlier about some families not receiving CARES Act stimulus money. why, through your research, why do some families not get government assistance even when they try to?
Yeah, well, specifically with the CARES Act, you know, I think part of this has to do with who is sort of paying federal income tax, who is banked, right? So who was it easy for the government to find because they were in quite a hurry to get these checks out. So I think there are some reasons and challenges associated with just finding people, which is part of this. But also, I think from a consumer or customer standpoint, it's not always obvious how to access available government services. And government programs aren't always, you know, either well advertised or they have really stringent requirements for what you need to demonstrate to get protections or to get assistance. And, you know, people who have limited time, limited assistance, find it challenging to navigate through these channels. And the academic literature, we refer to these as administrative burdens. And, you know, we make things hard to do in this country. And accessing these kinds of assistance programs is just one more thing that is difficult for people who have, you know, limited time and limited resources to do so.
What other ways can those families get assistance aside from the government?
Right. So, I mean, obviously, you know, the government provides some resources if you can access them. What we're finding in our research is that people are looking to nonprofit organizations for cash assistance and, of course, relying on their own social networks, friends and family, faith-based organizations. You know, when people are faced with these kinds of material hardships and are confronted with having to make very difficult trade-offs between paying utility bills or putting food on the table, you know, people, you know, will look for any help they can get, right? And there's no single story to that. People often are, you know, confronted with this challenge, and they do the best they can to make ends meet. And it's sort of a constant challenge that they face.
Let's look at an adjacent issue here, Kerwin Olson. Can you explain how Indiana's moratoriums on eviction and utility shutoff helped low-income households?
Well, they help low-income households by ensuring that they're living their life in dignity and healthy and safe environment. So the moratoriums were absolutely critical to protecting Hoosiers during these trying times. They did exacerbate some payment difficulties. We're seeing some extraordinary arrearages right now from utility customers. The community action agencies who do intake for low-income assistance are realizing a significant increase in the number of applications, but also a significant increase in the amount of arrearages that customers are facing when they come in to fill out their application. Some as high as $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 in arrearages. And speaking of funding, and to David's point, there is still available funding. There's a $350 benefit available to utility customers for help paying bills that's available through the Indiana Housing and Community Development Association. But as David pointed out, the qualifying for that was a little bit burdensome, and many people were unaware of that. But there's money still available that's there to be had for those affected whose incomes have been affected by the pandemic to get some help.
How many disconnections did we have after the moratorium expired? I mean, you don't have to give me an exact number, but what did it look like compared to other times?
Well, you know, the moratorium, the shutoff moratorium expired on August 14th. And so the most recent data we have was filed the end of September by the utilities. And to be frank, we were hoping that in August we would have seen zero disconnects, because we were hopeful that the utility companies would at least give customers at least one billing cycle, at least 1 month, to ensure that they had time to set up a payment plan and get their financial health in order. But in August, we saw around 3,000 or 4,000 customers across the state of Indiana disconnected, and we're expecting to see much higher numbers in September. But they won't report those September numbers until the end of October. So we're a little concerned by what kind of disconnect data we're going to see. But we saw virtually no disconnects, obviously, between March and August 14th. So the jury is still out as far as what the disconnects will look like in comparison to year over year. And we'll have more information on that come the end of October.
Can you illustrate what happens to families after they're disconnected from their utility services and the sort of spiral that can happen after?
Well, you know, we're talking about a refrigerator to, keep your milk cold and your food fresh. We're talking about hot water to shower and bathe and clean. And we're talking about heat in the wintertime and cooling in the summertime. So We have seen tragedies occur where in the wintertime folks have used their ovens or other dangerous equipment to heat their homes. And we've seen people die as a result of losing service. And we've seen the same, if not worse, in the summertime when people lose access to electricity, can't run their fans, can't run their air conditioner. And people, it's not an understatement to say people lose their lives because of losing service. But it's also exacerbated by the digital world that we live in today. When you lose access to electricity or internet or whatever the case may be, you can't do your job. You can't go to school online. So your whole life is turned upside down when you are losing access to these services. And they face a lack of dignity and struggle in getting by. And that's heartbreaking.
We're talking about energy insecurity here on today's show, specifically with Indiana, but also nationwide. And we have with us David Kaniski, who is a researcher with Indiana University's O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs and also principal investigator of a new study on energy inefficient energy insecurity. And also Kerwin Olson, who you just heard, executive director of Citizens Action Coalition. So, David Kaniski, what nationwide changes do you think would improve this situation during the pandemic?
Well, I think an immediate sort of emergency solution, if you will, would be to put in place a national moratoria on shutoffs, right? As Kerwin was just mentioning, the state of Indiana had a temporary policy in place for many months. It expired in August. Many other states had put in place similar disconnection protection policies. And some utilities had their own policies, but these were patchwork. They expired at different times. They included different provisions. I think to get us through, you know, the duration of this pandemic, whatever that duration will be, who knows, it would be a great first step to take a pause from disconnections across the country in a similar way that you've seen discussed around evictions, right? I mean, people are really going through challenging times, and I think this would alleviate some of the immediate dislocation that would happen through disconnections. So that's one thing that I think would be quite helpful. I think longer term, we need to think about this problem in a more macro way, right? First, we need to raise awareness and recognition that this is not just a problem because of the pandemic. This is a chronic situation for millions of low-income households across the country. And we need to find ways to, you know, to sort of emphasize energy efficiency, to provide, you know, more cash assistance in emergency situations, and to sort of treat this as a problem that it is in terms of its magnitude. And I think that will require a sustained investment of the federal government, as well as perhaps more emphasis at the state and local level in terms of providing needed help across the country.
Kerwin Olson, do you see more of a chance of the state stepping in versus the federal government at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, I think it needs to be a combination of both. I think at last check, you know, the state of Indiana still had somewhere over $1 billion or so in available CARES funding that, you know, should be going out the door to help. You know, some utility companies are struggling with revenues. Certainly customers are struggling, but I think it's where we need a cooperative relationship, not only between the federal government and states, but also local units of government and local utilities. I think it's a sort of an all hands on deck. But what we have to stop doing with utility assistance is placing this extreme burden on the nonprofit sector to shoulder this burden. An example would be there was a field hearing on a rate case up in South Bend a couple of years ago where the United Ministries of South Bend referenced that 98% of their poor relief they send to utility companies to help customers with their utility bills, leaving only about $3,000 a year in charity assistance to help with other things such as clothing, food, shelter, and medicine. And so we also have to look. We've overemphasized the nonprofit role, if you will, placing so much burden on the nonprofit and charitable sector to address this issue when there's so much more that we could be doing, especially at the state level, to reduce these energy burdens and make people's lives a little bit easier.
How often do you get a chance to plead your case at the state house?
Oh, you know, at least once or twice a legislative session, you know, when there's a an energy or utility bill being discussed. We certainly do our best to raise the the affordability crisis that customers face. And then we have ample opportunity before the commission. But unfortunately, when you're talking about the regulatory process, you have to wait for a utility company to file some sort of petition. And then furthermore, it takes lawyers, it takes experts, it takes money. To intervene in a case, hire the attorneys and necessary experts to provide evidence, which puts an enormous burden. Again, CAC is part of that nonprofit sector that is doing all of this work to try to improve Hoosiers' lives. Yes, it's an enormous burden on us. So we don't get that opportunity as often as we like. At the State House, a couple times during the session, at the commission, we certainly have that opportunity. But it's an expensive venture. It's a complicated venture that requires funding and an understanding of how to navigate that process. It shouldn't be this complicated. And the burden of proof should not be solely on the nonprofit sector and us advocates.
We have a listener voicemail from Ryan. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Ryan Camp from Indianapolis. Had an issue with my electric company, IPL, this year. Had a couple disconnect notices in a row, just had a hard time catching up on the bills. And after I got my third, I was required to make a $400 deposit or they were going to turn the lights out. I found it to be punitive as I was already having a struggle paying my bills. And then after getting three, being just 1 month behind for 3 months in a row, triggered a mandatory $400 deposit or my lights were going to be shut out. And I hear that that was an IURC, Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission rule. And I just thought that was really interesting. I thought maybe the guests on L1 today might have something to say about that, maybe what Kerwin Olson with the Citizens Action Coalition, what they might be doing to rectify that situation. Thank you so much.
Kerwin Olson, it sounds like a similar issue to what we heard earlier from Bobby, although on a much smaller scale. I guess this happens fairly often.
Yeah, I mean, here's a 45-minute or so radio show where two of the calls have been about excessive deposits being charged to customers who couldn't afford their bills in the first place. And again, this is where I would just repeat my answer about elected officials and policymakers need to come into play. But furthermore, part of the commission orders throughout COVID was a prohibition on late fees and deposits, which has since expired. And so, again, something we can do during this pandemic is prohibit utility companies from charging customers deposits. And we're talking about customers who can't afford their bill to begin with. So then we exacerbate that problem by adding additional deposits on top of that. And it's both, outrageous and heartbreaking at the same time. We need better policies to prevent these kinds of abuses from utility companies. It shouldn't be allowed.
Less than a minute left, David Kaniski. Do you think that this issue is going to continue to get worse because of the pandemic?
Well, I think there's some good reason to be concerned. You know, as we were speaking a little bit ago about these disconnection protection policies, many are expiring here in Indiana, but also across the country. So some of the protections that have been in place are going away. So as people now face, having to pay their bills, accumulating debt from prior unpaid bills, this is going to be a challenge moving forward. And of course, we're heading into the colder winter months, right? So paying for electricity or paying for natural gas to heat your home is going to be of tremendous importance. And as Kerwin was speaking about, when people are faced with lack of access to these basic energy needs, they often resort to dangerous, strategies to compensate, whether it's, using space heaters or using their oven as a heating mechanism. And, those can lead to really tragic results. So I think there is good reason to be concerned, and hopefully we take on this issue.
I want to thank our guests for taking the time today. David Kaniski, who we just heard, is principal investigator and professor, principal investigator of the study we were speaking about today, and professor at Indiana University O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs. We appreciate it, David. Kerwin Olson is the executive director of Citizens Action Coalition. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All In.